from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we'll be joined by Australia-born former ancient history professor Robert Moss, who has written a book called The Secret History of Dreaming, and it takes us into the role dreams and dreaming have played in shaping history, as well as the effect dreams have had on a range of important figures throughout human history. He'll also discuss with us a theory he's put forth of the kind of personal work that can be done with dreams and how what he calls active dreaming can help change individual lives. He joins us the hour ahead, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Robert Moss is a former professor of ancient history, a native Australian who worked with Aborigines on dreams and has done wide and expansive research on the role dreams have played in human history, with additional emphasis in his writing on imaginative flights and coincidences and synchronicity and how such forces have driven great lives and turned historic tides. Dreaming, we discover in reading Robert Moss, is something that affects military intelligence and political propaganda, or has affected it during the period of the Inquisition. Also influenced the establishment of Christianity in the West, the production of oil in the Second World War, as well as significantly affecting the lives of Joan of Arc, Winston Churchill, Harriet Tubman, and Mark Twain. Robert Moss is author of The Secret History of Dreaming. He joins us for this forum hour. I'm glad to have you here. Welcome.
Good to be here, Michael.
Well, there's so much in this book to talk about. We were getting into it before we even went on the air here. But I guess, when I first decided to read your book, I thought of the fact that Robert Louis Stevenson had a dream and wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes.
The benzene dream came about as a result of a dream by a chemist. But so much of what you're talking about has more to do with the shaping of history, really,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it's an attempt to write the inner dimension of history, the role of the imagination, of dreaming in the expansive sense of not just night dreams, but how people's minds have gone into a deeper territory, the imaginal realm is one term for that territory, and how they brought through creative solutions in all areas from that realm.
Well, some fascinating examples historically. I want my listeners to know about these right away because they're just so, astonishing, I guess is the best word. And one of the ones that comes to mind first is the discovery of oil in Kuwait before the Second World War.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. Here's this colonial Brit. His name is Colonel Harold Dixon, former political agent in Kuwait. We're talking 1937. He's in his blue and white house overlooking the sea. And he's a dreamer. And he's in the habit of waking his wife up in the middle of the night when he's had a good dream and getting her to write it down. And one night the colonel wakes up with a dream of a mummy coming to life in the midst of a desert sandstorm under a strange tree, a cedar tree, not an American cedar, an S-I-D-R tree. And the mummy comes to life, becomes a beautiful woman, gives him a gold coin. And he gets his wife, Violet, to write down the dream. And then the next day, he goes to see an old Bedouin woman dream interpreter. He was fostered by the Bedouin. They regard him as one of those colonial Brits. And she says, I know that tree. It's in the Birkin Hills. And there's treasure there, and you should get your people to go there. So he persuades the Kuwait Oil Company, on the basis of his dream, to move a rig from the dry hole they've been drilling to the Birkin Hills, and the result is the discovery of an immense oil field known to history as Birkin No. 1, the root of Kuwait's oil history, oil wealth, therefore distantly the origin of the Gulf War, but more importantly and immediately, a major source of petroleum for the Allies in World War II, and therefore a major contribution to Allied victory over the Axis in World War II. The result of a dream of a mummy coming to life. This is mainstream stuff. You hear this, you recognize that dreams are not some New Age flakery. I mean, they are central to major events.
Or the skeptic would say, well, it's just one of those things that happened. They got lucky. The oil was under there and, it might have not happened. You remember the skeptics.
But there's a process of getting lucky here, Michael, and let's notice if it's just a matter of getting lucky, we want the process for getting lucky.
But the skeptics always say you remember the hits, you don't remember the misses.
Well, they might say that, but I would say go give it a try. I mean, if you can discover one of the greatest oil fields in history by working with a dream, I think it would be worth giving it a second try, particularly given the mess we are in. I mean, for goodness sake, wouldn't we have done better? We couldn't have done worse by paying attention to dreams and coincidence instead of what highly paid economic forecasters and risk analysts have been telling us. Isn't it worth looking to extraordinary sources and resources?
Wall Street should be using dreams rather than what they have been using, one might argue. Let's look at some of these other historical examples, in fact, because, again, they really are pretty fascinating. We go back to a woman by the name of Lucrecia de Leon, who you write about from the Spanish Armada. So beautiful, one of the Inquisition investigators said that a dead man would rise up and make her pregnant. And her dreams were actually used not only for military intelligence, but for political propaganda purposes.
Yes. This is a fascinating story. It's a very important story in the history of women, as well as the history of dreaming, because we don't have that many written sources, because guys wrote the history and controlled the societies. We have 415 transcripts of this young woman's dreams from the time of the Spanish Armada. Thanks to the Inquisition, they didn't record the dreams. They kept the archives. They kept the files. The reason that we have records of her dreams is that this beautiful, young, noble woman of Madrid was thought to be such an accurate predictive dreamer and such a good source of juicy political propaganda that powerful people in Spain in the time of Philip II had her dreams written down every morning by a compliant priest and had an armed courier waiting on horseback at the door to gallop with the dream reports to the headquarters of the Mendoza clan, one of the powerful family, to hand over the transcripts. Why were they so interested? Well, first of all, this young woman dreamed the wreck of the Spanish Armada 1 year ahead of time. She dreamed other major political events. She'd have dreams in which a man holding a lion on a leash would take her into the house of Sir Francis Drake in England, and she would listen in on what the enemies of Spain and England were plotting to do to the Spaniards. And she'd get behind the scenes, behind the closed walls of the royal palace in Madrid and see what the king and his cronies were up to. And sometimes that was pretty juicy information which political enemies of the king found it expedient to make use of. So they turned some of her dreams into playlets. There would be theatrical performances of her dreams in the house of a duchess in Madrid. This is the kind of history we haven't been told, Michael. It's fascinating, it's fun for its own right, and it does show us that there have been periods in history when dreams have been valued in a way that seems quite exotic to our modern society, but is very fun to learn about.
Yeah, also fun learning about Harriet Tubman and her West African ancestors. You tie that to the Ashantes, who were trackers, to her father, who was supposed to be a dream predictor who used dreams precognitively, and how it ties in with the whole Underground Railroad and the escape from slavery. This is
one of the great heuristic, one of the great educational stories from American history about the possible importance of dreaming and doing the vision thing. I mean, here is an uneducated, obviously, young black slave under oppression on the eastern shore of Maryland who suffers a terrible wound. She takes a 2-pound lead weight in her forehead, thrown by an angry overseer, suffers what we would call a near-death experience, comes back, and then has this facility for entering a dream state, sometimes in just 5 minutes, which she sees things of the future, finds herself flying like a bird over landscapes she's never seen with ordinary eyes, and from those aerial maps takes navigational guidance on how to get through the posies and the guards and get to freedom, gets herself to freedom, goes back again and again, takes other escaping slaves to freedom, and in her practice perhaps also carries, as you mention, a shamanic dreaming tradition of West Africa, of the Ashanti people, who value the dream tracker, who can go out with the leopard as their power animal and find the game animals the people need. And I think that lived in her blood. We can't prove decisively to the satisfaction of particular scholarship that she was Ashanti, but there are a couple of contemporary sources that mention the Ashanti in relation to her. It's a fair guess, looking at the records of the slave traffic, that her family came from the Gold Coast, which is Ashanti territory.
Well, the study of some of these African tribes and the way they use dreams and your work with Aborigines, thought of Murray Gell-Mann, the famous physicist who studied quarks and gave us quarks, wrote about a jaguar and being in an encounter with a shaman, and the shaman said, he'd said, I had a dream about a jaguar last night. The shaman said, yes, that was me. I know I was there. These kinds of things to the rational mind, of course, all seem woo-woo. I mean, it's like near-death experiences, of which you've had three that you've remarked upon of your own. And I'm wondering about, you know, when you look at dreams, there seem to be kind of two major tributaries. One is Freud, Royal Roy to the unconscious, and, you know, disguised wishes, even trauma can be a disguised wish to escape the trauma, nightmares. And you've got Hobson over in Harvard saying, oh, it's just a fluvy, you know, just flushing out. There's no meaning to it whatsoever, as opposed to all this precognition, premonitory, and really mystical notion of dreams.
Well, you say mystical, and that's accurate, but it's equally accurate to say pragmatic approach, because one of the things I make clear in the book is that for most human cultures across most of our history, dreaming has been regarded as a highly practical matter, maybe even essential to our survival. It has been understood that dreaming is part of our human survival.
Physiologically,
kit.
Too.
Physiologically, too. I mean, there's a current theory. I mean, I write about it in the book called Threat Simulation. It was coined by a Finnish psychologist, cognitive psychologist, mind you, which holds that every night in the brain, whether or not we remember our dreams, we are rehearsing the threats that lie ahead, so we'll recognize them faster, respond faster. That's part of it. I think it goes beyond that. Most cultures have believed that one of the reasons for listening to dreams is they show us the possible future. They show us what lies ahead. They prepare us for challenges and opportunities that lie ahead. They might be prophetic in the sense that they show a big future for lots of people. They might be predictive or precognitive in the sense that they show a specific future, or they might be early warnings of something. Most humans have looked for dreams, for guidance on the direction to take in life. They've looked to dreams for the future. Most humans, most societies across history have had very little interest in the personal subconscious in relation to dreams. That is what we primarily look at over the last 150 years. But for most cultures, that's the stuff you throw away, like the Egyptians threw the brain away when they mummified the body. What is interesting is the transpersonal, precognitive aspect of dreams and the possibility that dreams put us in touch with the moreness of life, with a deeper mind, a deeper understanding, maybe with what our M-theory physicists, our superstring physicists, and our parallel universe physicists are calling the hidden dimensions of the physical world, the seven or so hidden dimensions. Maybe dreams take us there too.
To what is invisible, essentially.
To what is invisible to the ordinary
senses. In
the
material world, yeah.
But maybe real. But maybe real. Now, I'm highly pragmatic about this. I mean, I want to test the dream experience and see whether it's working or not. If it's not working, I'm going to come at it a different way. So, yes, you might consider it mystical to think that you're in touch with other realms or can see the future. But for me, it's a matter of what works practically in life. And one of the things that works with dreaming is, you know, Michael, puts you in touch with your creative source, your bigger story, your inner compass, your deeper purpose.
Lightning. Dreamwork,
yes,
is a game that you have fashioned. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons that dreaming and dreamwork hasn't been a popular movement in our society until recently, it's becoming one again, is we haven't had a quick, fun, high-energy, activist way of working with dreams. So lightning dreamwork is a four-step process by which you can tell me a dream or any other experience from your life, actually. It doesn't have to be a sleep dream. And I or whoever is talking to you will guide you through the four steps. Step one, tell your story simply and clearly. You need no training in that. You know how to tell a good story. But a lot of people do. A lot of people need to be able to help, be helped to claim the power of telling a story and holding an audience. So the first step is to teach people to tell their story simply and clearly, just the facts, hold your audience, give it a title. Step two, whoever's guiding you through the process will ask you three simple questions. Feelings, Michael. First of all, how do you feel about it? Whether it's a coincidence or a dream or whatever from your life, what do you feel about this? And the assumption is that your feelings are the first guidance for you on what something means to you. Secondly, reality check. Two aspects. You know, you've dreamed something. What do you recognize from this in the rest of your life? And hey, could any of it play out in the future? We don't want to miss future messages and dreams. And finally, what do you want to know? Step three, I will say to you, if it were my dream or if it were my life, I'd think about such and such. Notice, I'm not going to interpret your dream or your life for you. You are the only authority on your experience. I'm not your guru. I'm not the expert on your dreams or your life. I'm going to give that power back to you and make you take it, like it or not. I will not tell you what your dreams or your life means, but I can say to you, as a frequent flyer who's been around these territories, I can say, if it were my dream, I'd think about such and such. And anything that comes into my mind might be relevant. You mentioned the jaguar of the physicist, and I told you about a vision of my own in the night of a jaguar on my bed, which turned out to be a shaman from Belize. So I will tell you something from my own life that comes to mind. And finally, Michael, you tell me a dream, you tell me anything from your life. We've had a discussion. I'll say to you, so what are you going to do now? What is your action plan? How are you going to avoid that possible wreck on the road next Tuesday? Are you going to buy the red shoes you were dancing in last night and call the guy up so he'll take you out? Are you going to do some research into that funny word or that funny connection? And just to get temporary closure within the action plan, can you come up with a bumper sticker, a one-liner, a snapper, Mark Twain will say? Can you come up with a good, juicy phrase from all of this that you can put on your bathroom mirror and let live with you for a while?
Well, Twain used to sit down and write. He said, if you write a letter to someone and you don't mail it, you'll hear from that person. I mean, he had all of these kind of beliefs. And again, areas that we normally think of as being beyond the rational. But the story that you tell about Twain is a fascinating one because he was headed for Brazil and he was headed to be maybe a cocaine dealer of all things, or at least to be involved in cocaine in some fashion.
Shall I tell that story?
Yes, of course.
I think the Mark Twain chapter is in some ways my favorite in the book. It's just so darn funny. I mean, it's impossible to write an unfunny story about Mark Twain, but here's the story of how he became Mark Twain. He was Sam Clemens, right? And he was working in print shops. He was working in a print shop in Iowa, and he reads a book about Brazil, which he's never heard of, which describes a wonder plant in Brazil, the coca plant, which is presented to some kind of, you know, panacea. He thinks, oh, he'll make a killing. He'll get to Brazil, wherever the heck that is, get some supply of this wonder plant and make a financial killing. So he sets off down the river, gets to New Orleans, finds there are no boats going to Brazil. No one knows how to get there. So he's disconsolate, but he runs into this colorful Mississippi riverboat captain called Horace Bixby and persuades Bixby to take him on as an apprentice riverboat pilot, which is a good meal ticket in those days. So now Sam Clemens is on the river gathering material for all those wonderful Mississippi stories and tales for which he's best known, and he takes up his pen name Mark Twain from the Mississippi River boatman's cry, Mark Twain, safe water, 2 fathoms. So the snapper, the astonisher from all of this, as Mark Twain would call it, is this. Because Sam Clemens could not find Brazil, he failed to become the first cocaine dealer in North American history and became Mark Twain.
And the dream notion in that, or the tie-in with the imagination, or the tie-in with what you argue?
Dreaming for me is not just about sleep dreams. It's about the play of coincidence, play of synchronicity, the interface of mind and matter, and the play of imagination. So the book and my approach covers all three things.
And in fact, many examples of all three things, as well as, though, examples of dreams being a formidable role in people's lives. I mean, all of the people who do dream analysis and take dreams seriously enough to keep records of dreams and so forth, including some of our founding fathers. But when you were talking before about solving dreams, I thought, of course, about the story of Jung and Pauli, the physicist. I mean, you've kind of patted yourself a little on the back for solving that one about the mystery of the Chinese woman.
Yes. Here's Wolfgang Pauli, Nobel Prize-winning quantum physicist, who said, by the way, that dreams were his secret laboratory, where he did his best work. How about that? And who recorded and shared thousands of dreams over the years. You want an example of the proximity of dreaming to real science? Look at the life of a scientist like that who lived so closely with his dreams. He helped Jung to develop his synchronicity theory, though Pauli didn't like the word synchronicity very much. Anyway, there was a mysterious character, mysterious sexy character in some of Pauli's dreams, the Chinese woman. And she dances like a snake dance, and she's very alluring and very beautiful. But he's often in trouble when she is around. And there's something going on with mirrors that is off and scares him. And Jung, of course, is saying the anima and using these other archetypal terms, etc. What happens? And I cracked this. I mean, I will take credit. I, with the help of a physicist friend who helped me to look at the history of physics, there was something called the Chinese Revolution in physics back in 1952, in which two Chinese theoretical physicists, aided by a Chinese-American experimental physicist, Dr. Wu, overthrew a principle in physics known as the parity principle, which was one of the solid points, one of the fixed points in Pauli's often volatile universe. He wanted to sustain this theory. Their breakthrough discoveries in physics shook his universe to its core. Now, in one of his dreams of the Chinese woman had given birth to a child and the world would not acknowledge the child, and he was troubled by that. When the Nobel Committee gave the prize for this discovery, this Chinese revolution in physics, they honored the two men, but they ignored the woman who had done the experiments, the Chinese woman who had done the experiments to prove the new theory. So Pauli's dream of an alluring Chinese woman giving birth to a child that was then ignored and neglected by the world was played out in full. As far as I know, no one has drawn these threads together before now. It's an example of making connections that become interesting.
Yeah, I was wondering if Watson and Crick had a similar dream since there was a woman who didn't get credit.
That's right. Yeah.
And Freud, again, getting into this precognitive notion that you have about dreaming, Freud actually had a dream about his own mouth cancer that he writes about in Interpretation of Dreams without probably knowing that he had the dream.
This is another story we have not been told. I've only found two sources of this story. The first one, the person who broke this story is not myself. It is an Argentine oncologist and psychiatrist called Jose Scavalzon, who compared the symptoms described in Freud's famous Irma dream. This is the 1895 dream that Freud analyzed, his own dream involving a patient he called Irma, who has strange oral symptoms in the dream, scarrings and scabbings and discolorations, and something like a prosthesis in her lower jaw. And it was Freud's work on this dream that he says was the foundation of his psychoanalysis, of his analytical theory. This was the birth of psychoanalysis. Well, the Argentine oncologist compared the description of the symptoms in Freud's Irma dream in 1895 with the symptoms diagnosed in Freud 28 years later by oncologists. The symptoms of the mouth cancer that killed Freud a few years later, in the course of which he had to have a prosthesis in his lower jaw, and of course it became almost impossible for him to eat. What's going on here? Well, it is possible, Michael, that one of two things was going on. Either it was precognitive, he saw 28 years ahead of time what the symptoms of the mouth cancer that killed him might be like but failed to get the message, or else it was what people in the field, the medical field, might call a tumor marker. The first cancer cell was already there and was flashing within his body, through his body to his brain to his mind, sub-signals about how it might develop if allowed to go unchecked.
How about the third possibility, that it just came out randomly into his unconscious or into his dreamscape?
Well, that's a possibility. I think the matchup is so close that we would be terribly impractical not to look at that. And hey, if it is remotely possible that we can have an early warning 28 years ahead of a situation which might enable us to avoid it, why not work with the information?
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Robert Moss, and his book is out and it's available, and it's called The History of Dreams. By the way, he will also be Tuesday, tomorrow, January 13th, at Reader's Books in Sonoma at 7:30, and Thursday, January 15th, at Copperfields in Sebastopol at 7 p.m. And we're talking about really the power of dreams, dreams as an engine, dreams as, well, along with coincidences and synchronicity, as a fascinating subject that includes such things as knowing the possibility that there's a future in your dream, or that it can be tied to the future, or helping you heal, if that's the case, as you suggested with Freud. A lot of this, as you say, is emotionally based. And we had a neurologist who was arguing that these emotions that you have about things like this really can't be trusted, that you need to trust the rational mind, that people who have belief, for example, in something that can't be seen are convinced that that belief is true because it's in their emotions, and their emotions are not what can be trusted.
Well, I'm a great believer in feelings, and I mean the first spontaneous feelings, not the feelings after you've thought too much about something. I'm a great believer in instinct and in the gut too, Michael. I'm a great believer in how the body knows things before the brain picks up those messages. So when I talk about feelings, I'm also talking about somatic impressions and sensations. The sensation that tells you to get out of a room when a guy is about to go ape in the corner of the bar, and you don't know that, but you know it's time to leave. I'm very interested in anticipatory symptoms, how the body experiences something before the event takes place that explains it. And there's been a lot of laboratory work done on that recently. So when I say feelings, I'm talking about the whole gamut of ways we know things that we don't know that we know.
Intuitive.
Intuitive, yeah. And instinctual. I'm a great believer in feelings. I'd rather trust the feelings of the gut and the heart than the thoughts of the brain as a first feedback on what is going on. I think I'll get into less trouble. So the talking head can go on talking, and I'll listen to him, and I will work with what he says too. But when it comes to appraising the importance of an event like a coincidence or an episode in the office or a dream, I'm going to go with what my gut and my heart and my first feelings are telling me.
Well, I'm going to open the phone lines and find out what our listeners have to say about this. The Secret History of Dreaming is Robert Moss's new book, and you can join us if you have some thoughts, or certainly if you have some questions or comments. We welcome your involvement in the program. It's live and it's interactive, and you can join us now toll-free from wherever you're listening or however, on the radio, the internet, or the Sirius XM satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. And again, please feel free to join the program and let us know what you think about the power of dreams, particularly precognitively, or of coincidences, or of synchronicity, or of all these things that we're broaching here in this discussion. Again, toll-free number 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and we'll hear from you, our listeners, now. But we'll also talk some more about some of these historical examples that are pretty fascinating, as I said. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Robert Moss, author of The Secret History of Dreaming. And I was just saying off air that I always wanted a dream to guide me toward writing a book. It never happened. And he said, well, this is viral. Maybe it'll happen after this discussion today. It certainly has happened for you as an author. I mean, it's been a major figure.
It's happened repeatedly. I mean, of course, for book writers, it's a bit harder than, to say, visual artists. It's hard to bring a book through in the day after you've had a dream. But a dream can inseminate an idea for a book. Some of the ideas of my books have been inseminated that way. Also, dreams can solve narrative plots. You know, you're writing a novel, you're missing a bit. A dream can give you the bridge, either as the dream or as a narrative borrowed from the dream. The Secret History of Dreaming, it would be no secret, but greatly inspired by my own dreams. I found myself dreaming of the characters in my book. Wolfgang Pauli, for example, one night, seemed to spend the night in my bathtub, in my house, bobbing up and down like a rubber duck. And I woke up laughing from the dream, just knowing that I'd, although I'm a scientific ignoramus, I would be able to handle Pauli as a dreamer.
Let's go to our callers, and we'll begin with Jory. Morning.
Good morning. I'm about 53 years old, and I remember as a child there were many older people, like grandparents, stories that I absolutely trusted before the days of telephone, and they talked about how when a parent died in Europe, they came as children from Europe, that they had dreams about the parent saying goodbye. And this is something I've heard more than once from more than one relative. And in relating these stories over the years to people, I've heard other people with very similar stories. And in every case, it's been someone that was absolutely trustworthy, at least to the person relating the story. So that's just what I wanted to share.
Right.
And I'll take it. Any comments off the line?
Jory, we thank you for that. And comment from Robert Moss.
Thank you, Yuri. I think that one of the principal reasons why people have valued dreams cross-culturally across the ages is that they have believed they have authentic communication with their departed, not only at the point of passing, but afterwards. And I've come to believe myself from my own experience, including my experience of my father's visitations after his death in Australia in 1987, I've come to believe that healing and communication are possible between the living and the departed across the apparent barrier of death. And it's interesting, we have a new president coming to the White House who believes the same thing. In his book, Dreams from My Father, Barack Obama writes about a very big dream in which healing and reconciliation begin a year after his father's death in a prison cell in which his father is confined. Now, you can take a psychological interpretation of that, but I personally suspect, and I suspect the next president of the United States also believes, that direct contact and communication and healing is possible in this way. It's an important thing to think about.
It is. I'm voicing my own skepticism here, although I must tell you, I had a dream recently, my father, who's deceased, spoke to me, and the voice was so clearly and recognizably my father's. And I wasn't even sure what he was saying, but I woke up with this feeling, boy, that was really something. I mean, you know, it's an invigorating and wonderful feeling when those you've loved have passed on and they come to you in dreams.
Yes, it is.
It just feels good.
It is.
Whatever it means, I don't know. But
you just gave me a shiver, Michael. I guess your psychiatrist might think that that's not a valid emotional response, but you gave me goosebumps, which is one of the ways I recognize truth. I'll say this to you. The number one reason why men have shared dreams with me across the ages, not just in workshops, but anywhere, has been they've dreamed of their dad after he died. And it feels real. It feels important. They want to talk about it. It's a big and sometimes life-changing experience. And we need to know how to discuss these things.
Well, lots of people want to discuss things with us. Our next caller is Clayton. Morning, Clayton.
Good morning. I wanted to share, I've been a tile setter by trade all my life. I'm now 47 years old.
A tile setter. Wasn't that right, what you said?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah, okay.
I've been, for years, when I have a particularly difficult layout or a particularly difficult job to figure out how to do, I may be going to sleep at night. Obviously, I'm kind of thinking about it, but invariably, I wake up with a solution. I don't often remember the actual dream,
yes,
but I often wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning going, aha, I
yes
know how I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I love this, Clayton. Thank you for sharing. Thank you. We solve things in our sleep. Thank you for giving us a personal example of this. I know a plumber who's done work for me who will always go to sleep before he has to deal with a difficult plumbing problem and wakes with a solution. He says the same thing you say. Sometimes he doesn't remember the dream. He just knows what to do. That worked out for a rather smart guy called Einstein in 1905. He was on the edge of something. He told his friend about it in Bern the night before. He didn't quite have it. In the morning, he had the special theory of relativity. There is, contrary to some of the dream books, no evidence Einstein remembered his dreams from that night, but he woke with a solution. Pretty cool to think we can solve these things in our sleep.
And we thank you for the call, Clayton. We go to more of your calls, so let's go to Frank. Frank, you're on.
Yes, hi, this is Frank calling. I wanted to get your thoughts about lucid dreams.
Right.
I am an avid, I have lots of lucid dreams about 2 to 3 times a week. And they're wonderful, but I'm having a hard time controlling them. And I was curious to see if there were some techniques that I could apply to be able to be in control of those lucid dreams.
Well, I think the thank you for the question, Frank, and for the personal sharing. I mean, I think the key thing is practice, practice, practice. How do you get good at driving an automobile and figuring what lane to be in to get on the right road going to Marin? I mean, practice and recognizing the roads. I would add this, that there are many approaches to lucid dreaming. I prefer the term conscious dreaming or active dreaming, in fact, because lucid dreaming is a phrase that comes associated with a particular mode. But without bandying words, let me say this, Frank. Here's something you might like to try. You've had an experience, whether it's a lucid or a spontaneous dream. Try going back into it when you're in a relaxed state. Try and put yourself back into the space you were in with the intention that you will operate proper navigational controls as you re-enter. That's one of the techniques I teach. I call it dream reentry, going back into the space of a dream, whether spontaneous or lucid, and going on with it with a conscious intention. I'd like to exercise more control. I'd like to go to resolution. I'd like to spend more time in Hawaii. I'd like to talk to my dead father, whatever the intention might be.
And we thank you, Frank, for the call. More of your calls in just a moment. I want to remind you that we're talking to Robert Moss, author of The Secret History of Dreaming, all about dreams in terms of, guidance, healing, creativity, the secret engine of dreams, precognition and premonitory dreams and all that, but also about dreams historically. And when we think about dreams historically, we must mention Churchill, because Churchill really used his dreams in governance.
He did. He did. The towering thing about Churchill is actually his imagination. I would say his historical imagination. He was able to master, it seemed, the streams of history that are relevant to making decisions today and to carry that sense into the future. So we're looking at a master of imagination and a master of vision in the sense of not only being able to develop a personal vision, but being able to transmit and transfer it to the minds of others and whip people together into a certain kind of resolution they might not otherwise have had. But dreams in a narrower sense of night dreams being important in a life are very central to Churchill's life. When he was a boy at school at 14 years old, he told his friends that the day would come when London would be under attack and he would be at the helm of Britain. Okay, grandiosity, egomania at 14. Well, it was fulfilled. The dream of his wife Clementine on the eve of World War I is interesting. Churchill would love to fly. He was one of the patrons of early military aviation, and he loved to fly. He was going up in these little early planes and like flying caskets, and his instructors are getting popped off and killed all the time around him, but he's brave. He keeps flying. And his wife finally telegraphs him a dream, which isn't a dream of a plane crash, because he wouldn't pay attention to that. It's a dream in which he has an idiot baby that is really an embarrassment. And of course, Churchill was a rather baby-faced kind of character. And Churchill looked at the dream and it finally got through to him. I think he said in his inner self, I'm the idiot baby. And he stopped taking the flying lessons for the rest of World War I. And it's arguable that that saved him to be the war leader of Britain and thereby the Western democracies in 1939. And I tell in my book a remarkable story of a Churchill dream. It is a dream of his departed father, Lord Randolph, who died rather young, coming to Winston when he's 50 years after his death for an update on world history and probably saying things like, Winston, you've got rather plump, and why are you painting in the corner? What have you done with yourself, my boy, in the 50 years since I passed on? Churchill wrote this up, and he didn't initially intend it for publication. It seems to have been a true sense of visitation from his father, in which he's giving a history of the world to his dead dad 50 years after his father passed on. An amazing story from a world-famous historical figure of a dream encounter of a kind that can move and speak to all of us.
And with respect to governance, Churchill had dreams, yes?
Oh, yes, he did. Yes, yes.
We'll get another caller on here. Martha, good morning. Or, I'm sorry, Sujatha. Do I have the name
Hi
right?
There.
Yes.
That's correct.
Join us, please.
Dr. Moss, it's an honor to speak with you. I was going to ask, all my life, I really have believed in instinct, and I want to ask about the connection between deja vu and dreams, because there are times when I have lived an entire situation. I could have sworn I've
yes.
lived it. And
yes.
I know what to do. I know if I do this, this is going to happen. And if I do that, that's going to happen. And my husband just thinks I'm cuckoo. So,
So Sujatha, you're telling us that when you have the sense of deja vu, it then gives you some guidance on how to behave in that situation. It's not just recognizing something, but it gives you a sense of how the situation is going to unfold. Is that what you're saying to us?
That's exactly right.
Right.
I know what's going to happen if I do A and if I do B, and I can pick.
That's very interesting. Well, the connection between déjà vu and precognitive dreaming is very close. Déjà vu, of course, means in French already seen. The more exact term would be déjà rêvé, already dreamed. We say déjà vu, but we usually mean actually already dreamed. The thing is, with déjà vu, we usually don't remember the dream. We recognize something beginning to unfold in waking life. We know it from somewhere. There are all sorts of theories about where that knowledge comes from.
Oh, you know the old platitude. It's déjà vu all over again.
All over again, exactly. But it's all over again because I would contend in 95% of the cases, we dreamed it ahead of time. We'd forgot the dream, but when waking life begins to catch up with the dream, we recognize something. And if, like Sujatha, you are then able to make wiser choices because you've been prepped for it and rehearsed for it already, that is very cool.
Actually, the novelist Don DeLillo, in an interview, told me that déjà vu may have something to do with our ability to connect to temporal time in a way that we can't when we're fully conscious. In other words, to future time, as you're suggesting.
Well, this is the heart of the matter. I'm not surprised that Don got to the heart of the matter here. I mean, a lot of this is about being able to step outside the constraints of regular time. When we shift consciousness, when we go dreaming, when we step into mind as opposed to simply brain, the computer made of meat, I would contend, and others would contend too, that we step outside the rules of linear time. Einstein himself said time is only a human convenience. I mean, we can step outside it. A medieval scholastic would say that when you go dreaming or when you shift consciousness, you step into the avum, which in the medieval mind is a space between time and eternity. It's a spacious now. You can travel forwards or backwards in time and check in on what's going on in past or future. My big dream from yesterday morning, Mike, which I was referring to you obscurely, was about the ability to time shift back and forth between one time and another. And I saw this so clearly and so plainly and practiced it in the dream. I think I'm going to write a book about it.
It may have something to do with your being on this radio program, because everybody can time shift now with iPods and listen to radio any time of day.
That's
really
true.
That's what we call it, time shifting, in fact. Literally.
Oh, you do? Okay,
we do.
Good.
You know, you write about Joan of Arc and you write about, the grove of those old trees.
Yes.
and her dreams and their use and so forth. And I was thinking to myself, you know, she heard voices, of course,
yes,
and voices spoke to her and led her into military battle and so forth. A lot of people hear voices and they call it psychosis. A lot
right.
of people hear voices and, you know, Son of Sam heard voices.
Right.
And
right.
you make the distinction again between what is maybe beckoning you as an authentic voice and what might be from some kind of, I don't know, demonology or bad influences of bad films or whatever.
Well, we're going to judge by results for one thing. Let's just take Joan of Arc as an example of results and judging by results. Here's an illiterate peasant girl in her teens. She persuades the rough, brutal warlords of France, who would normally only have use for a girl like this in bed, not only to listen to her, but to follow her and let her be the general of France, the chief of the armies. How did she do that? It wasn't because they had religious credulity about her voices. They didn't necessarily believe in her voices. They trusted the results. She was able to tell them what was going on a battlefield a long way away. She was able to tell them this knight or this lord was going to get killed on that bridge before it happened. Her information, her intelligence was so exact that they had to follow it, and it won battles for them. Now, how did that intelligence come about? Well, you can take a credulous religious view of it, which I don't. I look in the book at the possible story of how she did her vision thing, and I relate it to the ancient tree seers of Europe, predominantly women, who Julius Caesar feared greatly when he was fighting the Gallic and Germanic tribes. These were women.
Were they the same Ides of March with Caesar?
It was his wife, of course, had dreams warning him of the Ides of March. She wasn't a tree seer, but she was a dreamer just doing the dream thing in the night. He didn't listen. He had to be the brave boy. Of course, Caesar listened to his own dreams just for a second on the tree thing. Joan of Arc characteristically was able to do the vision thing, see across space and time, and produce effective information which impressed people when she was in contact with a certain kind of tree, a special tree. That was her place of vision. Originally, it was a beech tree in an ancient oak wood at Domremy near Lorraine. Later on, it was a châtaignier, a sweet chestnut, which I visited. I stood with that tree, and I had the impression of beginning to see a little bit as Joan of Arc might have seen, seeing the English positions in the siege of Orléans, and seeing as a
this
little
part
bit
of what you call your dream archaeology.
Yes, yes. You see, how do you get to the inner side of history? You've got to read the documents. I'm a history professor. I haven't been an employed history professor a long time, but I operate like one. I know how to do research. I trust documents. See, I've got footnotes. I go to the archives. But I also practice putting my mind into the landscape, the mental landscape and the physical landscape of the people I write about and try and enter the experience I might have had, and using my imagination to flesh out what the documents do not tell us. But the documents are respected.
Let me go to some documents here that are sitting in front of me that are called emails. Here's a listener says, please ask your guest whether he is familiar with the Japanese phenomenon Kanashibari. I have interviewed hundreds of Japanese. Each describes almost the identical experience, waking from sleep, being held down by a ghost and floating above one's body.
Wow. Being held down by a ghost and floating above one's body. Well, of course, in English, this is the original meaning of nightmare. The nightmare is not the way we use the word today. It is an unwanted presence that is on top of you, sometimes stifling you and closing off your breath, and you want to get out from under it. So there's a word for this.
Succubi and incubi.
Well, yeah, they might be doing something in addition to these two things, and not very nice things. All of these are probably, I mean, if they're real experiences, they may well be. They're probably examples of some kind of psychic intrusion, some kind of energy presence in your space, which you don't want around. I mean, this is not good stuff. I wouldn't relate this to dreaming so much as to the need for us to have healthy psychic boundaries and to create some distance between us and the collective or personal energies of the dead and other beings that we don't want around in a negative way. When you try to, I mean, this is a personal interpretation, perhaps, when you look at some of the strange things going on in the world, you sometimes feel the presence of entities that are undesirable riding the living and pushing them to do things they really should not do.
You're talking about what Yeats called Spiritus Mundi, aren't you? The world of spirits.
Spiritus Mundi for Yeats is the world spirit. It is the collective world spirit. But certainly Yeats was a great student of interaction between humans and the realm of spirits.
And here, well, he was a theosophist for a while. At least he followed Madame Blavatsky's philosophy.
Briefly. He got
indeed
out of that fairly quickly.
All that automatic writing and all that. Well, here's William from Orinda, who says, I remember a story in grade school reader about Elias Howe, I believe that's his name, working on a sewing machine unsuccessfully until he dreamed of being surrounded by jungle natives brandishing spears with holes in the blades. When he moved the thread hole from the back of the needle to the tip, his machine was successful and became the basis of the Singer Sewing Machine Company.
Thank you for reminding us of that. That's one of the great, I mean, truly great examples of the role of dreaming in the history of invention and technology. I mean, the invention of the sewing machine needle given to Elias Howe by a dream brought through a new phase of the Industrial Revolution. And it is something you can track as directly the result of a revelatory dream where somebody is prepared by his study and research to understand the symbolic dream as the key to a technical problem. The same thing went on with the benzene ring, with Kekulé that you mentioned earlier. He saw something like an Ouroboros, a snake biting its tail while in a state of reverie in front of the fire in Brussels. And because of his scientific preparation, he recognized that this was the key to the code of the benzene ring. The prepared mind is the one that is ready for luck, as Pasteur said, to paraphrase him. Luck favors the prepared mind.
Deborah writes, I can personally attest to the truth of the body knowing about illness and other major happenings because I both dreamt and intuited my own pituitary tumor before it was ever diagnosed. The mind has the peculiarity of running on, playing, if you like, in ways that don't necessarily mean much, but the body always senses and knows in a subtle way. Sometimes if one is seriously ill, it will show up in subtle or uncharacteristic or sudden behavior long before the doctor's diagnosis. Or if one lives in a war area, for example, one's instinct can pick up on initial violence and turn it into a predictive or warning dream.
I'm very glad to hear that message. You may want to check out my blog. If you go to my website, you'll find it. There's a piece there called The White Queen Gambit on this particular theme.
Let me tell listeners the website. It's www.mossdreams.com. One word, mossdreams.com.
Thank you. You may remember in Alice in Wonderland, the White Queen screams before she pricks her finger. When she pricks her finger, she doesn't have to scream because she's already done it. She has an anticipatory response. Presentiment is an old word for this. The body knows something and responds before the event takes place. I'm very fascinated in this phenomenon. Recently, I went for my annual physical, and my blood pressure went through the roof when they first registered, which surprised me because I was feeling very calm and very, you know, and the nurse is looking at me. And I said, well, let's see what happens next. Then she goes to take the blood, do the blood work, and she sticks a syringe in the crook of my arm, and she produces a gusher. I've never seen anything like this. Blood is spurting all over the place. I don't know how she did it. Blood is all over me. And she's apologizing, cleaning up and stopping the blood. And I say, now read my blood pressure again. My blood pressure now is completely normal. I had the spike in blood pressure before the incident that the incident would explain. The doctor came in. He's a very skeptical, rationalist, no-dream kind of guy. He said, I think you're right. I think we just have scientific data confirming the possibility of anticipatory symptoms. A lot of this, Michael, is about what the bleep do we know that we don't know that we know?
And, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And tapping into that.
And sometimes just, well, you know, I'm thinking about, as you're speaking, about a recent experience I had where I was having some elbow difficulty. It turned out to be tennis elbow, but I don't play tennis. It was just sitting at the computer writing too much. And I went in and I thought to myself, and this never happened before, I thought to myself, you know, I've not had my blood tested in a while, and I've fasted, and this would be a good time to get my blood tested. And I had been pre-diabetic for many years, and I thought, maybe I've crossed that Rubicon. And something prompted me to get my blood tested, and sure enough, I turned out to be diabetic. And then I thought about it afterward. Was there something, you know, prompting me coming from the netherworld or something that I couldn't? Or was it simply the fact that it occurred to me randomly? And I don't think we necessarily, again, know what we know or don't know in instances like that.
Notice the poetry going on here, the rhyming going on here. I tell you a story about the elbow, which I mentioned, elbow of my arm. It prompts you to tell a story involving elbow. Life rhymes. I'm borrowing from Mark Twain. He said, history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. I would say that life rhymes. And whatever you make of it, you have more fun when you notice these echoes and resonances. Your ultimate model of reality, okay, we can leave that on one side for a moment and just enjoy the experience.
Well, I tried Twain's trick, you know, that he claimed you write a letter
to someone. Mental telegraphy,
yes. Yeah, and you write a letter and don't mail it. No, it didn't work. But anyway, here's Heather who writes, when I was a child and young adult, I used to have fantastic, colorful dreams. Over the past 10 years, I seem to dream about mundane, everyday tasks. For example, I dreamed that I took out the trash in the kitchen and then was surprised to find it still full when I woke up. I seem to do a lot of cleaning chores. Could this point to me being stressed out or preoccupied, or do you recommend looking deeper? Maybe I need to clean up my life.
I think that's quite self-aware and quite wise. You know, if I had that exact same dream about the kitchen, I'd have a number of thoughts, because for me, the kitchen is not only the place of food and nourishment and maybe a family center. For me, in my dreams, it's my creative center. It's where I cook things up. So I would notice, if it were literally my dream, that if I've taken the trash out but the trash is still there, I need to clear more space in my kitchen for the new creative projects and enterprises that are coming through in my life. So I'm very much, I think, with the person who sent that message. And I take that quite seriously. I wouldn't regard that as mundane. I'd regard that as a helpful advisory on making the space required to cook up whatever needs to be cooked up now.
It's funny how some people, you know, have almost an aversion to hearing dreams. They say, it would be more boring than hearing about your dream, you know, like cleaning up a kitchen or something like that. And yet at the same time, there are those of us, you, me, fascinated by hearing dreams just because of all that it conjures and all that it makes us associate, and the rhyming, as you said.
The more boring, mundane, trivial dreams are often the ones that contain most precognitive or premonitory information, because a lot of life can be relatively routine and mundane. So I would say, for example, a woman...
Most of life is.
For example, a woman tells me a dream in which her boss comes into her cubicle mad at somebody else, bangs his fist down on the table and spills her coffee. Might sound sort of boring, except in the dream she's really stressed and speaks to him sharply and wakes up thinking she might have lost her job. So I say to her, okay, she wants to call it a boring dream. I said, it's not boring to me. Reality check, could your boss behave like that? Could he act like a two-year-old because he's mad at someone else? Absolutely. Well, what's your action plan? She says, okay, if it happens, if it's played out in waking reality, I will be Miss Zen. I won't respond. I'll just be very calm. It was played out the following afternoon. Boss comes in, bangs his fist down, spills the coffee. She is Miss Zen, stays Miss Zen all afternoon. Boss comes back with an apology, a bouquet of flowers, and finally, in desperation, because she's still Miss Zen, Miss Cool, an offer that she can come along on a free trip to Cancun because he wants to make it up to her. So, you know, she did better by using a trivial, mundane dream. She got an apology, a bouquet of flowers, and a free vacation from the tyrannical boss because she used the dream information.
We're talking about dream information and the way it figures into precognition and all that, but so often the catalyst for dreams seem to be incidents that happened previously. Like, you know, I can trigger off a dream or trip off a dream by something that happens the night before or the week before, and so often the case.
Well, you can do that. I mean, I've been studying the Hawaiian vocabulary of dreams lately. It's really interesting. There's a Hawaiian term for a certain kind of dream, which is the result of eating the wrong way under the wrong circumstance, wild goatfish dream. I mean, they're like eating red goatfish. Wild goatfish dream in Hawaiian means it's the result of how you fed yourself yesterday. Maybe you ate too fast in the wrong weather, and that's all it means. You've triggered this dream, but it doesn't mean much. The thing is, Michael, we recognize in our dreams what has already happened because we know something about that. It is harder for us to recognize in dreams what has not yet happened in our waking world. So sometimes we stamp dreams prematurely with a stamp that says, in effect, I know about this. This is about my past, when in fact the dream is coaching us about something manifesting now or into our future. I've come to believe that in our relationship with time, dreams are more about the future, far more about the future than about the past. Of course, the past is with us. It reproduces itself. If it's got unresolved issues, we go on playing it out again and again and again. But I would contend that dreams are more about the future than the past.
Gatsby said the past is the present and the future too, isn't it?
That's right.
From Napa, Gail, join us. Hi.
Hi, good morning. This is a really fascinating show. And ironically, I turned on the program just as I was thinking about a dream. I had about a black panther next to my bed at night, wanting to get into bed with me. It was very cold in the room, and I had to make a decision, and I decided to let him in, being very wary about the fact that he was a very large animal. And some dreams are epiphanic for me. I remember them. I just log them in more than others. And I wanted to ask you about, because you were talking about a jaguar in bed with you who turned out to be a shaman from Belize, and I wanted to know more about that.
Okay. First of all, Gail, thank you for sharing this. How did you feel? Were you kept warm during the night, warm and cozy with the panther in bed? How did you feel in the morning?
I'm energized, actually.
Okay. Well, I can tell you more about the jaguar, but I didn't actually go to Belize, so let me tell you about another big cat experience. Would that be okay with you?
Yes.
I have a relationship with many big cats. I guess I'm a pretty catty guy. When I was traveling in Peru 10 years ago, I was worried about how I'd do in those high mountains, because I'm not particularly athletic. And the first night, a tiger that I know, came to me and said, I want you to meet one of the locals, in effect. And I met the puma, the mountain lion of Peru. And I understood from the puma, it wasn't speaking human speech. I'm speaking for it. I understood, you know, big cats took a while to adapt themselves to high mountains. You don't have much time, so I want to come inside you, not just into your bed, but into your body, and adjust your system so you can do better. So I had the experience of lying in bed with the puma coming into my body and adjusting my blood pressure and other things. And for the rest of that trip, Gail, I was like a puma or a mountain goat on those mountains. I was the most athletic, adept walker, had no fear of the heights. So whatever you think's going on there, I found that that cat was an ally in my body in adjusting my body's systems that made it easier for me to operate and get around in the high Andes than it would have been otherwise. So I'm a great believer through experience in cultivating a nice, friendly, cozy relationship with the big cats or whatever animal takes you on.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there with that, again, mystical-sounding experience. I don't know how else to describe it, but you can meet Robert Moss and meet this man of mysticism and mystery. Tuesday, January 13th at 7:30, he'll be at Reader's Books in Sonoma, and then Thursday the 15th at 7 p.m. at Copperfields in Sebastopol. And again, the website is www.mossdreams.com, his book, The Secret History of Dreaming. Thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Michael. May your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll, producers Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.